What I want to do is decipher the various notations I made for you on this. So actually, you know, after doing a lot of work with making these notations, right? I give it away at the end. You see this back down here? Okay. We're going to see political messages, moral messages, historical messages.
Okay, let's start here.
David?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay, today's February 7th. We're taping Chamesh Megillot. And now we're really turning towards the text of what you have before you. These are the first four chapters or so in Megillat Esther. And you see various notations that I have put for you on the circles. There are underlining, and there are triangles, and there are squares. You see that? Okay, if you're listening, I'm going to make this very clear. Okay. There is a hidden message of Esther we've been working with all along. I'm going to review it now because we've done it already. Right? The Gemara says, Esther min ha-Torah minayin anochi Esther astir. Most commentaries say that means that God doesn't have his name. He hid his name from the story. But there's another deeper essence to the story, is that the main message of the stories is hidden. And maybe when the rabbis thought that this book doesn't belong in the Bible at all, right? Kivun Vidoris, Kisfun Vidoris, Dabzayin, Yisakas Megillah, the Gemara says that the rabbis were not sure this book belongs in the corpus of the Bible. Full disclosure, the Dead Sea Scrolls has all the other books of the Tanakh in it, but no hint to Esther. Okay? No hint to the Chanukah story either, by the way, but these are post-biblical holidays that the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls seem to be oblivious. Okay, so Hanukkah, I understand they were trying to escape the Hashmonai rulers that they thought were corrupt by them, but the Torah story was should have been well attested, right? Well, all right, 150-200 years later, the rabbis were 250-300 years later, the rabbis were still debating whether Esther should be in the canon or not, right? Okay, so the Gemara maybe applying that and directing it to Esther's own day, said that it wasn't quite clear, even after the story took place, that this belongs together with Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu and Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay, so the hidden message is multifaceted. On the back, I have a political message, a moral message, and an historical message. Okay, the political message, I'd like you to be aware of a particular book. It's called The Dawn by Yoram Chazoni. Not to be confused with the book called Dawn by Elie Wiesel about the Holocaust. This is called The Dawn. I guess if you put the "the," you could get away with a different title. Right? So I consider this the masterpiece of applying the political messages of Megillat Esther to our time. Yoram Chazoni is a politician in Israel. Right. It's called The Dawn. It's worthy to read. Right. He takes subtle different textual points to make historical messages and political messages. And we will discuss some of those with these notations. Okay? As far as moral messages, this is what I consider to be the most important. Because the Tanakh is a book of morals. It's not an historical book, it's not a political book. The Tanakh is a book of morality. And I assure you the rabbis understood that when they might have said things like what we did on the first day about conflating the whole, or contracting the whole Persian Empire to 33 years, putting them in Simcha Hashverosh, possibly with Cyrus. The rabbis were saying, you know, I'm not interested in which Persian king he is. I'm interested in the moral message behind the story. Right? What did they do to deserve this type of punishment? Duh, it was Nezah Semra named Haman who hated the Jews. No, we don't look at historical events that way. If you ask what was the reason for the destruction of the second temple, you really think it was Sin Hasinam? It was an overwhelming force of Roman might that destroyed a very fractious and divided Jewish nation. Sin Hasinam really is what destroyed the second temple? Katzer b'katzer is why we, right? What do the rabbis mean? What wool are they pulling over our eyes when they said Katzer b'katzer destroyed the temple? The Jewish moralist says that if not for the fractious nature of what Kamsa Bar Kamsa reveals, or what the Sin Hasinam caused, right, God would have saved us from the Romans the same way he saved us from the Egyptians. That's what they mean. Okay? So we always look through history through the lens of morality. Here? Okay, it's our captors who just chained us to slave ships and taking us halfway around the world to sell us into slavery are immoral, and that for that reason alone we will survive them. Get that? Otherwise we should have disappeared into the dustbin of history with everybody else. Okay. That's what smart money was back then. Okay, that's the historical. Political, moral, historical, okay? Got this on the first class, and some of you may have missed it. Get the tape, get the recording of it. We discussed some of the historicity of our story, which king you think Ahasuerus is, right? Okay. Our conclusion is that he's Artaxerxes the First. Right? But that's seriously problematic with the Gemara that says that the reason for his party in the third year of his reign is because the Nebuchadnezzar ruled 45 years, Belshazzar ruled 23 years. Good, that's corroborated, you know that. And 2 years of his makes it 70, and he said, oh yeah, the Jews aren't returning, they're mine, I own them. I've done what Babel and Assyria and lots of others couldn't do. I've made them lose their aspiration to go to Israel. Now, that makes him, look at your chart, Cyrus. He's not Cyrus, right? And for the Gemara in the Sefer Rosh Hashanah to say Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes are all the same person, got that? That's really they're doing. See it? Cyrus, Darius, who's the third guy on this page, and Artaxerxes, who's the fifth guy on this page, are all the same person, says the Gemara in the beginning of Rosh Hashanah. Don't you see what that means? Right? It is revealing an absolute truth of what Megillat Esther is about, especially the first chapter. That Yerushalayim has been replaced by Shushan in the eyes of the people. Right? Did we do the number of 5,400? Right? Yeah. Okay. The Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash are being used for partying. The Tiferes of the Kohen Gadol is being worn by Ahasuerus. These are all wonderful midrashim that underline a basic truth. The Jews have given up hope of returning to Israel and deserve what they're getting from home. Because they have made their home in the gods. You can exchange these blanks for 20 other times in history. God's calling us home with a Zionistic movement in 1870, and you're satisfied to stay here in Germany and making that your home? Right? Right? For Berlin shall go forth Torah, from Litta shall Dvar Hashem from Litta, right? They were saying these crazy things in Europe. And here there's a movement where Jews can finally return. Right? Okay, so it's just that we did deserve in the Purim story some kind of response to the home. Other times in history, not as much. Oh, maybe the coldest winter of the 20th century, 1941, was also got some response from God. If that was a mild winter, this country would be Germany now. Okay? They would have taken over Russia. England would have been next. It wouldn't have been good. I'm not saying that they had a good outcome, right? But just saying. A book was recently written, by the way, by Jeff Gurak, Dr. Jeff Gurak in Louisiana. Teaches history here. Great historian, great American historian, some American Jewry. Just wrote a book, it's fascinating, you gotta see it, over what would have happened if Hitler was assassinated in 1939 and World War II was never fought. Goes through, and it's really very well written. And it is no one is as good as predicting what would happen if that was the case as this guy. He really knows that as far as the Jewish experience in America.
What does he say?
There is no state of Israel. America is a terrible hotbed of awful anti-Semitism. Russia Jews are already non-existent. There's no state of Israel, and America is a vicious hotbed of anti-Semitism, and Europe is worse. Crazy stuff. And he says it at the end of the book. I'm not saying here that the Holocaust is good for us. It's a classic show, right? But he just says that, you know, history is filled with events and morals and politics and right. And he conflates them. And I'm only telling you all of this regarding how it fits into our story here. Okay. And what the rabbis are doing when they are putting all these people together in one. That they are telling us something that may not historically be true, right? To put Ahasuerus right after Nebuchadnezzar's son, you got to keep it short, right? Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, and then Ahasuerus is 2 years. Oh, the third year, let's throw a party. The Jews are mine. And the Jews are enjoying such a meal? Nehenu misudnas Ahasuerus. You familiar with that Gemara? Shimon Bar Yochai says, why do the Jews deserve to be destroyed then? Shenehenu misudas Ahasuerus. Not that they just attended, but they enjoyed it. Don't you realize what this suda is about? Right? Okay, but to put Ahasuerus that far back first of all, it's contradicted by Tanakh. Tanakh says that in Sefer Ezra, who's alive much later, look where Ezra is. Ezra speaks about the return, the rebuilding of the temple, the refurbishing of Jerusalem, right? Ezra, the religious leader doing it, Nehemiah, the political leader doing it, and there was a king of Persia who put a stop to it. What's that king's name? Mentioned once outside of Esther. Very important. According to the Tanakh, he couldn't be so far back. It would make him over 100 years old when doing that. Got it? You with me? So with the day N plus in Sefer Ezra, in Sefer Daniel, he has a son named, get this, Ahasuerus' son is mentioned, Dariush. He has a son named Dariush. You look at our chart, we know what this is. Why we have to say, who Ahasuerus, implying that there's more than one with that name. Number four. Right?
It also means that at this time, the returning to Esau happened before Persia to go back.
Right, it's not happening so soon. You know, Haggai speaks about, there were Jews, some Jews did return, very, very few, not enough, but they did put together the workings for the Beis HaMikdash to be, if not fully built. You don't need a Beis HaMikdash for Kabbalah, you just got to go up there and make a Mizbeach, that's all. It means they didn't have a Menorah, they didn't have a Shulchan, they didn't have a house for these things, right? Some of them were made of wood at first. But, you know, the Gemara at the end of the Tzvachim talks about the ruling of how we slowly go back to initiating the Beis HaMikdash. What we're hoping for by Shlishi has a very vast difference of opinion. You know, Rashi seems to say, he says in a few places in his Torah Perush and a few places in his Gemara Perush, that the third Beis HaMikdash, right, is here, not here today, and fully functioning tomorrow. It's going to fall down from the heavens. Fully built Beis HaMikdash like Shlomo is going to just exist one day. So Rashi writes, Mikdosh Hashem Kodunu Yudach. That was as realistic as Rashi could be living in France in 1100. Right? Rambam, very different. What's interesting is that the religious Zionists, like Rav Kook, the Pastor, like the Rambam, the Sadr, believe like Rashi. Don't go to Israel now and start a political movement of Zionism before Mashiach comes. That's pushing off Mashiach. Mashiach was ready to come after the Holocaust. That's as bad as it got. And you pushed it off by making a state of Israel. Right? Just saying, that's what it is. Okay, is everyone clear about looking at this page for war values, right? Does everybody, I want you to feel comfortable. If you don't, go out and get some notes or listen to the first or second shiur of how every one of these prophets mentioned on the other side impacts our story. Okay? Daniel is the Chavir, Chagas Rehm Malachi, Yirmiyahu, the story of Gedaliah, the Redeemer of Mitzrayim. Okay? We'll review that maybe.
Okay, well, Daniel definitely impacts the story, like, after the people say that, like, half the characters are Daniel.
The main point I want you to know about Daniel is that he was confused about when the 70 years were over. You can't know when 70 years are over unless you know when 70 years start. Right? He didn't have a Sefer Yirmiyahu in front of him. The first Yirmiyahu. He said, I'm aware that Yirmiyahu predicted the 70 year goals. The thing is that Yirmiyahu predicted 2 70 year goals. One in chapter 29, one in chapter 25. Right? Go back to your notes because I don't want to read that. Okay, now let's look at the notations here, okay? First we have the political messages. What political message is derived from Tam Aleich? Very simple. He's not the son of a king. So, look at your chart, you're right, before them, he's the first. Artaxerxes second doesn't mean he's the son of Darius either, but Artaxerxes the first implies that Chazal may be correct when they say Hamoleich means he was not the son of the king. Now, since we don't have an Ahasuerus as a Persian king on our list, can I prove that? No, I can't. But let me tell you, this is how Midrashim work, especially at the end of the first paragraph of the Sefer Megillah that makes all kinds of historical claims about the story of Purim that I submit to you here. Underscore, listen carefully to this statement, underscore a larger truth about our story. And that truth is, it's so abundantly obvious, that as a man whose father wasn't king, he's always looking over his shoulder to see who wants, I took this kingdom from someone else, who wants to take it from me? You get it? Because when you're the son of the king, so everybody in the kingdom is thrilled that you ruled after your father and they basically will follow you. But when you're not the son of the previous king, you may be looking over your shoulder of wondering who wants to take it from me. This is crucial in understanding how Esther manipulates the story with her plan to get back at home. Okay? We're not up to that quite yet, but you get it? Plus, there's an element within the story, very conveniently tucked away at the end of chapter 2, where Ahasuerus has good reason to worry about people wanting to kill him. It's in the story! Right? Who are they? Bigtan and Teresh. There are people in the story who try to kill him. That's put in there so the reader knows this. Okay, you got that? That's Hamolich. Got it? The fact that Ikhu Ahasuerus is also crucial to this. Right? What else? What's this Vashti Amalka? And then I switch to Amalka Vashti. Turn down to look the circle. You see it? Vashti Amalka, then all of a sudden it becomes Amalka Vashti. Tell me why. Remember? Suggest something for me.
And she was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar.
Granddaughter.
So she was royalty.
Right, so she's royalty. He says, come out, Vashti Amalgam. Let me show your beauty to my drinking buddies. And she says, you cruel churl. You know, the Babylonians were much more refined than the Persians. That we know historically. The Gemara says, the Persians were like bears. They were like, you know, smothering everything, drinking everything. The Babylonians were very much more refined in art and science. That the Persians at this time were better at fighting wars. They destroyed the Babylonians. So the battle between Ahasuerus and Vashti is not just a spat between husband and wife. It's really a clash of culture. And she says, I'm not coming out here. You know, Gemara says she wanted to come out without clothes, because it says, let him come out with Keser Malchus. You get it? Rabbis have a funny way of, in other words, they mean just with the Keser Malchus. Right? Where is there a hint in the pasuk that he wants her to come out and clothe? Okay. So she walks at that. Right? Let me see if you can start to figure out how I'm treating Midrashim here. The Midrash says she would have been happy to walk out naked in front of the men, but she grew a tail. What is that interesting? Really? Actually, with a tail? What's it saying? Come on, talk to me. See, get something here. What's that Gemara mean? She would have loved to come out, but she grew a tail, so she said, I can't come out with a tail. Remember that scene early on in Harry Potter where what's the kid's name? It was a pig's tail.
Dudley, brother, yeah.
Very first one, the beginning, and then the Kaddish. So that's what happened to Vashti. So she didn't want to come out. That would be terrible. Oh, come on, guys, help me here.
It would have made her imperfect if she wasn't wearing clothes.
Okay, but what does that mean to us? These people are behaving like animals. These are animals. Animals do this kind of thing. That's something that royalty shows off his wife to right? To his drinking buddies like this. In Pshat, he just wants them to see how beautiful she is. Gemara says they were arguing over which women are more beautiful, Medes or Persians. And he says, I'm married to neither. I'm married to a Babylonian. Let me show you how beautiful my wife is. She's better than anything you guys have. Well, here you're king. Right? So by switching the Vashti Hamalka to Hamalka Vashti, you see what's going on? You're Vashti and you're the Malka because you're my wife. And she said, what are you talking about? I'm royalty. I know a lot more about being king than you do. My father and grandfather were real kings. So it becomes like a clash of Persian and Babylonian culture, and it's a threat. Because as you can imagine, when one culture takes over another, right? Especially at that time, you see the men are dying in war. The women are taken captives and taken as wives by the new guys, right? So you can imagine if this, according to Chazal, is right after the Babylonians are destroyed, there are a lot more women in Persia. Right? We kept the women and children. We killed off 450,000 men. What are we doing with their wives? Well, each man, one and two will. No, keep as our own. So there's a big clash of culture going on. So now you see why the end of the first paragraph, he has to get rid of this. Let it be a message for all men. What kind of kingdom needs to make a statement? Let all women honor their husbands. Don't you see what's going on here? I'll call this a political message, right? Between the form of Babylon. Let us wipe out all those. Was any hint of Babylonian culture. Let not those Babylonian women, lord it over their men. The way Vashti wants it. No disrespect. A disgusting nation that has to codify such a law. Okay, clear? All right. Now, another political message is, look at the list. You see two lists of men. Woman, Bizisa, Harvona, Bigsa, Baksa, Zesar, Harkas, Tim. Karshna Shesar at Musa, Tarshish Meris, Marsana Nabuchan, you see all that? These are meetings that Ahasuerus has with people when he's not sure of what to do. Ahasuerus seems to be a very timid, unsure, on the dime, he turns things around. That's why Purim is called the holiday of topsy-turviness, right? The Nahafohu. Everything is hafach. The beginning of the story, his best friend convinces him to kill his wife. At the end of the story, his wife convinces him to kill his best friend. Get it? This has some element of a connection to Yom Kippur, which we'll do in maybe one of our very last class. Yom Kippur also tries to turn things around, right? When they say Yom Kippurim is a Yom Kippurim, you get it? Have you heard that number? A Yom Kippurim. It's pretty strange. How is Yom Kippur like Purim? It seems to be diametrically opposite. No, there's some aspects that are very similar between the two of them. Well, the reason why I put boxes around all these names is because at the end of the story, I shouldn't say this, starting chapter 3, Ahasuerus does not associate with any of these men. In fact, he doesn't associate with anyone at all except Haman. Why? What changed? Why does he have a meeting with seven men before he even sneezes or puts on his shoes in the morning to decide what's going on that day? And then all of a sudden, in chapter 3, he's only talking to Haman.
Last part, we were discussing the guys because he's so unsure of his own kingship. If he makes a decision, he wants someone to blame. So he used to ask someone, and then he said, and if it goes wrong, he'd say, oh, it's his fault, and kills him. That's what they see, like, all that that's what he wants.
Okay, so what happens in chapter 3? Why does that change? Why does he only.
Well, we thought that it's either maybe because he wants to come on the left, or because Haman hasn't really done anything.
Well, what you see is that Haman is mentioned right, chapter 3, verse 1. What happens right before that?
I mean, he's paranoid because of the assassination.
Right, assassination. Is this Julius Caesar? And all seven of these guys have agreed to kill me? We're having this confidential meeting, the eight of us, and they're going to stab me one by one? Right? You know some really bad players in world history who have killed everyone in their inner circle. Stalin is the most famous for that. Now this crazy young guy in North Korea has killed practically every close relative of his. If you read the way that he kills them, he keeps everybody in line. Really nicely. Right? And he lines up 20, 30 people. You're familiar with this? Have you ever seen the way he does that? Shoots them from airplanes, bunch of rips them apart one by one. They watch it. Who else getting ripped apart on this? Or he takes, keeps 30. I think at least he took 30 hungry lions, kept them hungry for days, and then unleashed 30 lions on a group of traitors who voiced some opposition to a plan that he has. Okay, so. So Ahasuerus is worried that everyone who gets close to him, they want to kill him. So the text doesn't tell us why Bixen and Zeresh tried to kill him. The Gemara says it has to do with all of his nightlife, all these women in the gutter. Maybe what that means is that they say this is no way for a king to run the show. And Mordechai hears about it. How do people intending to kill a king or speaking loud enough for someone to hear? So Chazal say they speak in the language they thought that he certainly didn't speak.
They hold that wrong. But they speak that.
Tarshi is a bit better. But anyway, Mordechai understood it, heard it, and it's not quite clear. But what's better for us? Is it better for the Jews that this king gets killed? And we'll try our luck with the next guy. Right? Well, no, you want this king to remain king because a Jew is married to him. Right? Esther's already married to him at this time. Right? And Esther wisely puts another person on Ahasuerus' thank you list by saying, a man told me that there is this threat to your life. She doesn't say what he is to her or anything. She says, a man named Mordechai, who... Now, Mordechai is not a Jewish man. Mordechai is decidedly a Persian or is a chief god named Marduk. Pretty close to that. In fact, his consort is Ishtar. Right? So Esther and Mordechai are nice Persian names, the nice Jewish names now, but they were usually Persian names. Okay. Alright, so that's more political. Now look at I want you to take notice. What do all those triangle names have in common? Look at all the words in triangles. This is now, I'm calling this historical. Come on, you should get it right. What do these triangle names have, triangle words have in common? Nice, come on. Nixor, Bihishoma, Bihikovets, Yeose, Yinosein, Batitruka, Nixor, Oh, Bihivoda, Bihivukash, Bihikus, Bihikose, Bihimonse. They're all in passive verbal form. You were probably taught in the composition class in seventh grade, don't write with the passive voice. Write with the active voice. Right? Unless you absolutely have to. Right? But you should write with an active voice. Now what happens? Starting chapter 3, starting chapter 4, right? There is an active, we no longer see passive verbs anymore. Everything is active. All of the verbs, I skipped a few here, but you'll see. Tishlach, Vatikra, Vayitze, Vayayayet, Vayizah, Vayikra, Vayabo, Vayilbash, Vayitze. No passive verbs anymore after this, of that order. What message are you receiving? And until chapter 4, there's a plethora of passive verbiage. And then Megillas Esther changes its binyan. Binyan, hu'al, nifal, afal, yifil, right? And then all of a sudden, the Bible changes its tense, passive to active. What's happening? This is just such a brilliant pedagogical method that's happening here is that Megillat Esther is telling us that the Jewish community has become passive. We're okay with Ahasuerus throwing these parties. We have no political clout. We have to just roll with the flow. Right? There are some Jews who manage to return to Israel, but let's not rock the boat. It's amazing that while most Jews in Persia are behaving this way, there's a group in Israel called the Tzorei Yehuda, I think I wrote about that last time, who were busy trying to prove to the Persian kings that the Jews are a fifth column and they don't care about the success of Persia. They're Amnifrad, Mufosar, Mufurad, Mikolah, Amnim. They don't keep your customs, right? That's the Haman speech for why we should kill all the Jews, right? There's no point in holding on to that. You're not going to lose anything. In fact, I'll pay you to get rid of them. Right? So, what's interesting is that in Megillas Esther, Haman is called Sorer HaYudim. Right? Sounds familiar? Right? Sorer HaYudim. This is what they're called. Sorer HaYudim is what they're called in Ezra and Nehemiah. In Esther, we have Tzorer HaYudim. I think Haman was a part of this group. He may have been their head, directing them from Persia. Right? So it makes sense that in the book of Ezra, when there is a halting to the activity of rebuilding Yerushalayim, it's done by a man named Ahasuerus. I think that's our guy. Why doesn't Megillat Esther point to this? Go back to the beginning of today's class.
Because Esther is written with the knowledge that the Persians see it.
Yes, Esther is a hidden message. Esther doesn't want to make reference to what's going on in Israel. That's not the point. Who's the ones publicizing this book? The Persian runners, the Mahashtakanim and the Arab Mahadim, went, here you, hear you. Right? That's how we know this story. Esther wrote it and told her husband, the Ahasuerus, Shir, send this out. The Jews didn't have the wherewithal to make this publicized. Right? Okay. Look, this. You know, you could say Pesach was observed the year after God told us about it. Well, the year he told us about it, right away. But I'm not sure that Chanukah and Purim got off the ground just like this. The Gemara in Shabbos says, L'shona Acheres, they publicized this amazing miracle, of the twofold miracle of the war in the Pach Shemen. And L'shona Acheres, say the next year, it's some other year, it started to get hold. Right? Okay, but these Persian anti-Semites with Haman at their head, probably, were responsible for getting stopped. Okay? Now, historically, we know that Cyrus also put some stoppage to the rebuilding that he offered years back to chart. That might be because, remember I told you about Zechariah's 13 visions? Right? The first one that according to Barnell was a prediction of Alexander the Great's three kingdoms. Right? Three horses chasing a fourth. The last one is also three horses chasing a fourth. He says that one is Columbus sailing to the New World with three ships. Will change the scope of Jewish history. He was right. He did. Or it's stuck in the despicable morose of the European existence for so long. And it was just after the expulsion from Spain. Right? God, in the same time, the same year, 1492, some historians say it was the same day. Right? He sailed the day after the expulsion proclamation. So Abinel says that Zechariah's visions, 13 visions about the future, was setting in motion out of the Jewish experience in the exile. Okay. We have these different underlying themes relating to various messages that are embedded within the text Now, what I want to leave one thing is a religious message. Is there a religious message in this book? You know, we're faced with destruction. You don't have to be a religious Jew to say, what do we do about this? Right? So what did Esther advise Mordechai to do? It says, Lech Knosis Kol Yevim, bad the Jews, and fast for 3 days. Is that a religious form? Of course it is. She doesn't say pray. She says fast. Right? You assume that that's what it is. Right? In other words, improve yourselves. What is she saying fast for 3 days? She says don't eat day and night. That's a significant fast, 72 hours. Right? In other words, we need to do something to deserve God's intervention. Yeah, that's a religious message. Okay. We're still going to have a very serious status, no doubt. Okay. This is for when I'm only going to do these other sources at the end of maybe our last class on Esther. So Esther forges ahead a plan, and this is incredible. Chapter 31 of Yirmiyahu is a reference to the return of the Jews to Israel after the Galus is over. It's a beautiful parable. The book about Rashi, called Heichal Rashi, its author, he doesn't have written proof of this, but he says that Rashi's favorite parak in Tanakh was Yirmiyahu chapter 31. It's that Torah second day of Rosh Hashanah. The other 51 chapters in the book are pretty negative. This one is really positive. That after all my predictions for doom and gloom and destruction, this is the gnosis of the Torah, that you're going to rebuild and replant the land of Israel. Beautiful chapter. There's a lot of famous psukim in it. One of the psukim says that when you return to this land after the 7-year galus, I will create something new in the land. Something new will happen to you. And this is it. It's very cryptic. Nikkevah Tisovev Gever. The woman shall encircle the man. Now, in a practical sense, there's something we do at weddings because of this. Because Yirmiyahu had said a few times earlier in the book, things are going to get so bad no one's going to want to get married anymore. And just before this, he revealed to the people, that's why we sing it this week, if we're going through the wedding, what's Od Yishama Ba'ar Yehuda? Just say it, Yishama Ba'ar Yehuda. V'chutzos Yerushalayim, v'chutzos Abba Kosim, what's this Od Yishama, what's the Od do? Because he said, there will be no more. The original line in Yirmiyahu is, there will be no kol sason b'kol simcha b'kol hasan b'kol kalal. And then he says afterwards, now we're going to come back to a time where we will once again we'll hear the call of the bride and groom. Right? So the Minhagim tried to say, okay, at weddings, because every wedding is a sign that Yirmiyahu's words came true. The woman shall encircle men in the groom. How many times? That's up to me. There's 7, right? Okay? You got it? You've seen it at weddings, right? What's she doing encircling him 7 times? What's that about? It's a fulfillment of this prophecy. 1. 2. Rashi says that these 3 words mean that the Mekeva is a representation of Bnei Israel, the Gever is Hashem, and when these things come, you will not see open prophecy like you have now when I'm talking to you from God. You will have to pursue God at that time. Got it? The Kibbutz represents the Bnei Yisrael. What book of Tanakh would this be? Where there's a woman that represents Knesset Yisrael, and the man in the story is God, they're very much in love, and they're pursuing each other all the time, of course. They're pursuing each other all the time, but they never manage to want the other at the same time, right? He wants her, she's not interested, and she wants him. He's not interested, he knocks on the door, and he breaks through. Remember, called Latino Fake, where Soloveitchik Men wrote his book about religious Zionism with that title because he knocks at the door, and she doesn't want to answer the door for him. And then she goes in, I'll elaborate because it's on these sheets also. Right, so that's Rashi's, the Rav, etc., right? Got it? Okay. The Malbim says something that's really quite astounding. He says that the Keva is the land of Israel, Eretz Israel. The Gever is Bnei Israel. He says, no, it's not the woman that's Israel, it's the man that's Israel. Right? And the reason why he says this is because the Pasuk says that God will create Chadosh Va'aretz. I mean, the Rashi's parish is nice, God and Israel, and we did have to pursue God. But why is it Ba'aretz? Right? I mean, only in Israel this is true. Other places we don't have to pursue God. What does that mean? So the Malbim says, if it's Ba'aretz, that means that usually when a people go to a land where they haven't been living, they have to conquer it. It's a conquest. Sort of like the man has to pursue the woman. He lost Israel. She's Israel. He has to find it. You lose your wallet. Your wallet's not going to be you have to look for what you lost. I know that's not popular to say today, but generally you ask the girl out. Alright? You call her first. Right? Whether it's a breach of protocol for a woman to say, you know, I saw you at Kiddush this afternoon, would you want to go out for a cup of coffee? Right? Is she allowed to do that? Okay. You get the point. Alright, so the nekeva will tosovev gera, because usually when the people come into a land, there's a war. Like in Sefer Yehoshua, are you with me on that? Yirmiyahu is predicting, this is beautiful, when you come back to the land after 70 years, yeah, you will not have to pursue the land will pursue you, it will not involve a war. That's true. Who invited them in? Cyrus, that's this. Cyrus cylinder, right? Okay. So that is the Malbim's approach to this. Okay? I would add another element to it, that the success of that return will involve a woman. Her name is Esther. Okay? And I would even go one step further. If Rashi is right that this goes on, it would mean that when our exile starts to come to a close, women will be more active in the spiritual realm. Till 100 years ago, women couldn't learn Chumash. The only thing he taught your daughter was maybe to read Hebrew so she could daven for sin. And then they threw a bone. They wrote a Yiddish commentary to the Chumash called Tzeneren. Okay. Just to focus in. Remember, Chazal say, "Kotomar leBeis Yaakov v'sagei b'nei Yisrael." Beis Yaakov is speak to the women, and b'sagei b'nei Yisrael speak the Torah to the men also. So the women are mentioned first in the pasuk. Okay. The last 100 years has shown us very clearly is that educating women is just as important. Certainly early on, as educated men, maybe possibly takes precedence. Okay, we'll close with that. And I want to finish up maybe next week. Just Tuesday, Thursday, we'll finish up this week. Right? It would be nice to go all the way to Purim, but I don't think we need that much time. Okay, the next class will be dedicated to figuring out what is Esther's plan. Did she like wimp out the first day, or was that part of the plan? Okay, guys. Good job.